This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we talk with the author of a new critically acclaimed novel set during the Civil War. Paulette Giles' new novel, Enemy Women, reveals the horrors of war. The Collie family home is in the Ozarks of southeastern Missouri, the area largely Confederate in its sympathies. But the Collie family is neutral. The threat from both sides is great. Guerrilla militias murder, loot, and destroy homes. For a good deal of the war, the Collie family is left untouched. But then one day, the Union militia arrives and sets the house on fire. 18-year-old Adair, her brother, and sisters are terrified as their widowed father is beaten and dragged away by soldiers. Adair and her sisters, Mary and Savannah, set off to look for their father while their brother, John Lee, joins the Southern cause. Soon, Adair is arrested and charged with enemy collaboration. She's imprisoned in St. Louis along with other enemy women. Paulette Giles was born and raised in the Missouri Ozarks. She is both a U.S. and a Canadian citizen. Her poetry has received Canada's highest literary honor, the Canadian Governor General Award. Her previous books include North Spirit, Travels Among the Cree and Ojibwe Nations and Their Star Maps, a book of poetry, Celestial Navigations, and Cousins. Enemy Women is her first novel. It is published by Morrow. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Paulette Giles. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Paulette Giles, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us this afternoon, and congratulations. We understand that your novel has just been optioned by 20th Century Fox.
Yes, it has.
Congratulations.
Yes, that was wonderful news this morning. As I was waiting for your call for the interview,
yeah.
I got a call from L.A. So that was very nice.
So what are you going to do today to celebrate?
I don't know. I'm probably going to finish cleaning my stove.
Oh, dear. Well, then maybe after that you'll...
I don't know. I think Jim and I might go out tonight.
Yeah,
and,
I think
and
at the very
glasses.
Least. I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Well, what inspired this novel?
Oh, a number of things. I had, like most poets, I wanted to write a novel. And I thought I would like... I was doing family research, and I thought I would like to perhaps put it in the period of the Civil War in southeastern Missouri, where my family was. But apparently nothing happened there, so that was disappointing. And I had never been told anything had happened. But my cousin and I ride horseback quite a lot, and she took me to an abandoned or sort of lost Civil War graveyard that was very striking. And I asked the landowner, Rocky Sisks, this is my cousin's neighbor, and he said it was a battle here, and they sort of buried them where they fell, the Confederates on one side of the road and the Union on the other, and they were just stone slabs stacked up. And it had been confirmed that those were Civil War soldiers buried there, and that was the first time I realized that there had been absolutely desperate fighting going on in the area.
Yeah. In the acknowledgments, you thank a historian by the name of Jerry Ponder.
Yes.
And you write, he has persisted for many decades in the face of indifference. Tell us about his work.
Jerry has, it was after I realized that there was a lot of fighting going on in the area. Someone told me that I should get a hold of Jerry Ponder. He's a retired Air Force colonel, a very sophisticated man. He was attached to various embassies throughout the world in his career. And when he came home and retired, he began to research the history of the area. So after, and he couldn't get this stuff published anywhere. I guess people at that time weren't very interested in what they call the Trans-Mississippi. They were interested, publishers were interested in big battles in the East. Mm. And so I went to him, and so he told me where to get his books, which was at the little local courthouse and bookstore by the courthouse. And then I interviewed him many, many times, and he helped straighten things out for me and told me where else to look, and he was really helpful.
Yeah. Now, I think this history is fascinating. Why do you suppose it's been met with indifference?
Well, as I say, I think we were never taught anything about this. When I grew up, we were taught that there were two big battles. One was at Wilson's Creek, and the other, let's see, I guess it was the Battle of Lexington, Missouri, on the Missouri River. But I don't know. I am really at a loss to understand why, except as I said before, I think publishers and most history is concentrated on the large battles in the East, and that's where the war was really fought. This was sort of considered a backwater, and local feuds got mixed up with allegiances, and it was very messy. But so maybe that's why they avoided it, because it was so messy and it was so hard to figure out.
How many women were in prison during the course of the Civil War?
Well, I wish I knew, but not being a historian or an academic, I couldn't abandon my book to find that out. It was a very difficult thing to find out at all, to get any lists from Two Trails Publishing in Independence, Missouri. Carolyn Bartels had, it was either Carolyn Bartels or Joan Childs Eakins, had prisoners' lists for Gratiot, and I believe some for Alton, and I asked her to send me those. These were St. Louis area prisons, and then I could go down and find women's names, but I didn't know where else to go. But at any rate, I think that that would be a fascinating job for a future historian, someone who is a professional historian, unlike myself.
Yeah. Well, what can you tell us about how long, from the research you did for the book, about how long women were imprisoned, what they were imprisoned for?
Okay, this is strictly anecdotal. Being a novelist, though, that's what I thrive on, of course. Going through some of the lists and also Griffin Frost's book, Camp and Prison Journal, which is very informative about women prisoners, some were thrown in prison for collaborating, which is, means that you helped helped a Confederate soldier who might, this means you might have given a meal to your father or brother or cousin, and they were thrown in prison to be interrogated. Other were women who were caught smuggling things through the lines, like gray cloth for uniforms, or gold bullion, or ammunition. A woman, Mary Pitfield, was imprisoned for getting ammunition through the lines in order to supply Confederate, either regular Confederate or guerrilla Confederates. A 14-year-old girl was thrown in jail and threatened with death for having cut telegraph lines. What else? There were women in a ball and chain, and women who died in prison from typhoid and various diseases. So it was a little bit chilling.
Well, you quote Griffin Frost throughout the book.
Yes.
You open the book's chapters with epigraphs, many of them from letters and journals. And Griffin Frost, his account is quite amazing. Here he is expressing his horror and his anger. Great heavens, my blood boils.
Yes.
Women in this hole of filth and blasphemy.
Yes.
I could scarcely believe it until I saw it with my own eyes.
Yes.
Mrs. Mitchell, who is here with a little daughter, 5 or 6 years old, she is charged with smuggling goods through to the Confederacy.
What was her name again? I forgot that quote.
Mrs. Mitchell.
Mitchell, yes.
Yeah. One old man named Murphy has been added to our room, imprisoned, he says, for selling miscegenation photographs.
Isn't that strange?
Yes.
That Griffin Frost was so frank in his Camp and Prison Journal that I found it was one of the best sources for anecdotes. And that's just fascinating. I can't figure out what that means, but and why you would imprison someone for that. But it's very weird.
Yeah, and also children were imprisoned.
Well, I don't think they had any place else for the children to go.
They had to stay with their mothers.
They had to stay with their mother, yes, exactly.
Yeah, and
that's why in my novel, as you notice, there's an actress who is in prison for theft. My heroine, Adair, is not thrown into a military prison, but she's thrown into the general population, prison population of the city jail. And it's called the St. Charles Street Prison for Women. And she, in the jail for theft is an actress, and she has her little niece with her, Kezia. And the only reason Kezia is there is that she's an orphan, and her aunt's the only person who can take care of her.
Mm. The story's protagonist is a woman by the name of Adair Colley. She's young. She's She's 18 years old. She's a pretty remarkable character, isn't she?
She was delightful. She just sort of... I've had a lot of authors tell me this, that when they're really happy with their character, they realize that the character has sort of stepped into your life almost uninvited, and that's almost what happened with Adair.
Yeah. How did you begin to imagine her?
I had a very hard time writing the first version because I had a very weak character, and I knew that this was a serious problem because you can't have a novel with a lot of action in it with a weak character in the center because they just can't carry the weight of the plot. So, yet I didn't want to write a Scarlett O'Hara. You know, everybody who writes about women in the South initially get what they call scarlet fever. So, I wanted a strong woman, but independent, and of that sort of character. So I was flipping through a book of photographs, and the most striking photographs seemed to just jump out at me. And I sort of realized that that was Adair. And she's very beautiful. She's got very black eyes, very black hair, and a very determined and intent look on her face. There's nothing ladylike about her or retiring about her. And it's just like there she was. And so I began to go back, and I got rid of my initial character, whose name was Sarah, and then just began to write in Adair, and she just sort of took off.
Hmm. And she does, too, on horses, doesn't
yes.
she? It's not long into the novel when we begin to understand that Adair is a strong character, and it's in part through... her feelings about horses and,
yes.
and what they mean to her that
yes.
we understand who she is, what kind of a woman she is.
Yes. She loves being outdoors. She can't stand being confined. She's a person who wants life to move. And she gets her father gives her a lovely horse, and a very strong horse named Whiskey. And you have to remember at that time, she loved her horses very much, but also horses were the only means of transport. And to have a good, strong horse that's sensible means that you're mobile. A lot of people have commented on her love of horses and her determination to get them back, but she doesn't want to get them back merely because she loves them, because if she were on foot and her enemies were well-mounted, then, of course, she would be at a tremendous disadvantage. So, yes, she loves Whiskey, but she also needs him very badly.
Yeah, yeah. And also, she's a young woman who knows that marriage is not far off, and for her... I think Whiskey also represents freedom.
Freedom, exactly.
That's exactly all along,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's a very strong young woman, and she loves to be in the outdoors. And when she thinks about being married, of course, at that time, one married and one had babies, period, and being trapped by domesticity. And she thinks of it with great fear and not wanting to give up her life, and that's why she's so hesitant when she first meets the man in the book who represents her relationship, her love relationship. I would think the daunting task of being a housewife in the middle of the 19th century would have made any woman hesitate.
Yeah, I want to share with the audience here just a line or two to give us to share the sense of the frightening prospect that marriage, you know,
right.
was.
Right.
There were only a few years left to her before she would have to marry and be closed up in a noisy house, trapped by domesticity. Adair dreamed often of the waste places and their silences, places where nobody lived, and so there would be no smoke and dirt and ceilings and mindless talking, only herself and the clean snow and the way the world went at every cant and turn of the seasons, and herself riding through it. All that would be gone.
All that would be gone, she imagines. But of course the person with whom she falls in love is a very, very decent person, so mm-hmm. we can hope that Adair is going to have the best of both.
Yeah. I don't want to tell listeners too much about the plot, but I think
right.
we should talk a little bit about Major William Newman.
Yeah.
Tell us about him and how he comes to fall in love with Adair.
Well, when Adair is... accused of collaboration with the enemy, and she is sent to prison in St. Louis. What occurred at that time, as far as I can tell from my research, is that the women were independently interrogated by a Union officer who who's part of the Judge Advocate General's Department, which is part of the Provost Marshal's Department. And that interrogation would allow them to, if they gave information, they would receive favors of some kind, or perhaps it would be released. And the interrogation meant that they would give information, probably be asked to give information on their own relatives. So she is brought in for interrogation after about a week in the prison, and she and the major immediately sparks begin to fly. She is telling the major what he can do with it, and he's telling her that if you want out of here, I want information. And it's very sparkly. It's very strong, about 8 pages of dialogue, and I had a lot of fun writing it. And the major came alive for me in that dialogue. He's a bit of a stick. She calls him a stick. She says, you love paper more than you love anything else. And he actually is a bit of a stick, but he falls immediately in love with her. He's not entirely a man of paper. He has also been a member of the 7th Dragoons, which were in Kansas during the Missouri-Kansas conflict, trying to keep the two sides apart. So he's not entirely unacquainted with a life of action, but he's a man who definitely prefers reflection, and he likes his books. And then later in the book, he too is sent into battle once again. He's not entirely unfamiliar with it, though, as I said. So the two of them represent a kind of contrast. She is this wildflower from the Ozarks, and he is a rather stiff and proper lawyer who's in a job he hates, interrogating women. It's not very honorable. So the two of them meet, and sparks fly.
Yeah. Well, both of them are courageous individuals, and both of them are very intelligent.
Yes, and part of that is the attraction of one to the other, is the intelligence of one another. I'm getting my syntax mixed up here, but not only is it a sexual attraction, but it's an attraction to the other person's personality and the depth and flexibility of their mind.
Mm. And the sparks that fly are intellectual sparks, and because their physical relationship is chaste.
Yes, but I think the more powerful for being sort of restrained and buttoned up. I made a deliberate choice there to not have any graphic sex scenes, since we're so surrounded by them. I just decided I would be different and go entirely against, you know, recent entertainment or literary fashions and keep them all tightly buttoned up. But there are scenes, I think, of real sensuality and real attraction between the two.
Hmm. I wonder if 20th Century Fox will leave that be.
They better. I have yet to sign that contract. And I would go to great lengths to convince them that less is more in this case.
Will you do the screenplay?
Oh, no. No, it's not congenial to me. I don't care for doing screenplays. I find them very difficult. But I'm sure that I will at least have some say in asking them to stick to the book. Yeah. I hope.
I hope so, too. You've said this story is really, at bottom, a good old-fashioned folktale.
Yes.
Are you interested in folktales?
Very much so. I'm interested in their construction and the way they used narrative summary with such poetic effect. This book, and I don't mean to get too technical here, but it's something your listeners might think about. This book is technically not a novel. Technically, it's called a prose fiction romance.
Hmm.
And it has to do with a quest. It has to do prose fiction romances. Maybe I could explain best by giving you examples. The Old Man and the Sea is a very pure example of a prose fiction romance. The Odyssey. All stories which have to do with the quest of the individual as the individual strives through the world against difficulties or in search of some treasure or a lost home, things of that sort. And the bottom line on the prose fiction romance is the folktale. So you can see that The Old Man and the Sea has a very strong relationship to folktale more than it does the domestic novel, which is really an exploration of psychology and social relationships. Does that make sense? Am I being clear?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And that's really what it is. It's a folktale. The quest of the individual through the trials and tribulations of the world, or an alternative world, seeking out some treasure or perhaps trying to return home.
Yeah. I know you lived in Northern Ontario for some time, and I imagine that there were many long winter nights there where folk tales were told.
Oh,
stories
yes.
were
you
told.
You know, I am the most fortunate person on earth. I bet I'm one of the last people in the world to have heard those tales directly in the Indian language, in Ojibwe, from the mouths of the elders who had it passed down to them. From now on, it's probably all going to be on tape recordings or on written down. But yes, it was just wonderful to listen at how sophisticated they were. The legends as they were told, or the myths as they were told, were very sophisticated, and they were put together in really intelligent ways. In other words, information might be conveyed through dialogue instead of through straightforward exposition. And the storyteller would make that choice almost as they were telling it. So I found them delightful.
Can you give us an example of a theme or a story that you learned while you were living there that really has stuck with you?
Well, there is the legend of Ayash, which again is a quest tale of a young man who is driven from his home and goes out to sort of seek his fortune and goes through many encounters with very many strange beings, and through his own wit and courage manages to evade them. It's one of the favorite tales told in that part of the world. And Ayash, or the son of Ayash, wins through in the end to return home and rescue his mother and sisters. Mm-hmm. He's driven away by an evil father. Actually, he's abandoned on an island to die out in the middle of a huge lake. But many creatures come to his aid. And I could listen to that story over and over. I must have heard it 15 times.
Yeah.
This is wonderful every time.
Sounds terrific. Sounds like a great way to take a little instruction from one's elders in a very wonderful, painless way.
It was just special, and especially sitting around a wood stove with the fire burning and listening. It's very special. I feel very honored.
Yeah. How long did you live in Northern Ontario?
About 10 years. This would include some time in the Eastern Arctic as well, and in the Northwest Territories.
And you learned the Ojibwe language.
Yes, I did. I was never very good at it. It is very, very complicated language. It's very complex. But I did my best, and I got to where I could speak at about the level of a 3 or 4 year old. And when the elders were telling tales, there would usually be a young person my age who would sit with me and very kindly translate very quickly, almost under his breath, and then I also understood part of it.
Mm-hmm. Is your experience there in Canada, well, you don't live in Canada any longer, but your experience there, did that lead you to give the major an interest in language?
Exactly. You've put your finger on it. That's exactly right. Yeah. I used what information I have on Schoolcraft's Ojibwe lexicon, which is wonderful. And I used it, even though it was written down in 1856, the language was still very much as it was then. So I threw in Schoolcraft for the major, yeah.
And I imagine Adair is a horsewoman because you also love horses.
Oh, I couldn't go a day without horses, and I couldn't write a book without several of them as well.
You mentioned.
And I learned to ride side saddle.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yes. I knew perfectly well that no woman rode astride back in those days. And even if they had to sit sideways on a regular man's saddle. So I thought, I knew nothing about riding side saddle, and since so much of it was going to be her on horseback, I had to know how to do it. So I went to a friend of mine, Dr. Deborah McCormick, who trains Peruvians, horses. They're a very nice, docile horse. And she said, sure, I'll show you how. And so she had a Peruvian side saddle. And at first she said, I only want you to get on in your jeans in case something happens. And so I rode in my jeans, but then the next day I brought my big skirt out, and I said, God, I've got to wear this skirt. And it's very secure, and that's the problem, because once you're in for the duration. It's very hard to get out of them. But it was very secure. The horse even went into a little bit of a bucking fit, and I felt perfectly fine.
Huh.
So we rode around, and I got a feel for it, how one fits. You've got to be very careful and sit exactly in the middle of the horse. And put your weight on your right thigh bone, and don't use your left stirrup. You only have one stirrup, and don't use that for balance.
Huh.
So it was fun.
It's interesting that when you're in, because it looks so tenuous.
No, it's not. It's quite the opposite. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, so boy.
I mean, if the horse were to go down or something, you would have a very hard time getting out of the saddle.
When did women quit riding side saddle?
I was reading some accounts from some West Texas women who were born and raised on ranches, and I think it was around 1900. Mm. The women up in Wyoming, I think, with the ranch women, were the first to abandon the side saddle, and then the West Texas women actually were following. In fact, their dads, when a young girl started out, insisted on them riding astride because they didn't like the side saddle. They said it was too dangerous.
Mm, yeah, because if the horse goes down,
you can't get out. Yeah.
Let's talk some more about the story and some of the themes of this prose fiction romance. There's a moment early on in the book, foreshadowing perhaps. It becomes clear that the lives of this family are going to be changed by war. The father is a justice of the peace, and he tells his children not to argue. Be kind to one another, he says.
Yeah.
We are about to go to war. In the course of writing this book, did you think a lot about war?
You couldn't avoid it.
Yeah.
And the Yugoslavian conflict was going on at the time, and then September 11th happened. Of course, that happened after the book was actually in production. But I couldn't help but think about it, and it was really upsetting. And it's hard not to become passionate to the point where you step out of the story and you become an author's voice being angry or passionate about something. But people treated one another terribly, and it was very sad.
Yeah. Well, here in this book, you really get a sense of how close it is. I mean, when we see war, it's far away, and it's so removed.
Yes.
And here it's, you know, innocent people are losing their lives and their homes. And
Yes. And I just read it through it, and I thought, you know, we can never let that happen again under any circumstances. It was just, it's very bad. Maybe people will read it and appreciate what we have here, you know. We're safe.
Yeah. Are you a pacifist?
No. No, I'm not.
Hmm.
I don't know what to think, really. Like most people after 9/11, I'm very confused, I guess. So I can't tell you what I think because I don't know. I guess I'll know maybe in a couple of years.
Yeah. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Paulette Giles. We're talking with her about her novel Enemy Women. It is published by Morrow. Paulette Giles is a poet. Her poetry has received Canada's highest literary honor, the Canadian Governor General Award. Her previous books include North Spirit, Celestial Navigations, and Cousins, Enemy Women, her first novel published by Morrow. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. It strikes me that you really enjoyed doing the research for this book. At some point in your life, have you studied history?
No, I haven't. I did enjoy doing the research, and it was sort of wool gathering. I went off into areas that had very little relation to the book, just because I enjoyed it so much. I started finding all these peculiar, interesting things, like Griffin Frost.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a professional researcher, though, and I certainly admire professional historians. I'm a mere novelist and a tale teller. but I enjoyed it enormously, especially going up home to the southeastern Missouri Ozarks, which is where I'm from, and going into the courthouses and finding all sorts of narratives. It seems that people would write down narratives and then deposit them in the courthouse sort of for safekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
And I found all sorts of things that were unexpected and wonderful, personal narratives, even from, you know, the 1900s or 1920s of the hard times people went through, or little stories from the Depression, or 1870s, when the 80s, when they first started logging in the Missouri Ozarks. I found wonderful things. It was, and I had to say, stop, go back to your book. It's time to finish that novel. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, occasionally there will be a film made about the making of a film.
Yes.
You could write a book about the making of this book.
Almost, couldn't I? You know, that's kind of a good idea. That's a good idea. Thank you.
At the very least, a magazine article. I found myself, you know, wondering, you know, about this period in this part of the country. I mean, we're not at all that far from St. Louis and from Missouri.
No, you're not. And that was fun, too, discovering what St. Louis was like in the 1860s. That was wonderful. There was a terrific book put out by the Missouri Historical Society called The Art of the Daguerreotype, Thomas Easterly's Daguerreotypes from the 1850s, and I pored over them for hours at a time and all the wonderful details in the daguerreotypes that were taken at the time. So, no, you're not that far from St. Louis and from that part of the country.
Well, it would be so interesting to go now to my own courthouse and kind of mosey around in
and
there.
And what courthouse would that be?
The Champaign County Courthouse.
Oh, wonderful. You will be surprised at the things you find in courthouses. Just lovely stuff.
Hmm. And also there's a very nice archives just at the Urbana Public Library, full of wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things.
From what is the county?
It's Champaign County.
Champaign County. Oh, my goodness.
And
I imagine they would go back quite a few years,
yeah.
maybe a century and a half or more.
Oh, at least.
Yeah.
At least. Maybe a listener will call in and tell us how far back the collection goes. But
exactly.
It's got to go back at least 170 years,
yes.
I would think.
Yeah. I guess George Rogers Clark came through that area in, what would it have been? The Black Hawk War was 1750s?
I don't know.
At any rate. At any rate, it's there to be discovered.
Yeah. Was there a document in particular that you came across or an account that you came across that was particularly, you were just stopped dead in your tracks, just stunned by it?
Yes. Well, besides Jerry Ponder, there's an absolutely marvelous book called Inside War by Professor Michael Fellman of the University of British Columbia, of all things, in which there are many, many, many quotes and excerpts from soldiers' diaries who were sent to southeastern Missouri to fight, and that was heart-stopping because they were very frank about what went on in their diaries. They were soldiers from Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Colorado, brought in as federal troops, and as I read through Inside War, that was hair-raising. And then, the West Carter County, Missouri Genealogical Society has printed accounts of J.J. Chilton and others who were alive during the Civil War and wrote up their memories in the 1930s when it was published in the local newspaper. And the Carter County Genealogical Society has reprinted them now. And I read through that. My great-great-grandfather disappeared during the Civil War.
Mm.
I've never been able to find out what happened to him. And when I first started reading these accounts by Chilton and others, the killings were awful. And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to run into them in this book. And I didn't want to, and I didn't. So that's how involved you can get, I suppose, when you're writing a novel.
Yeah.
These things. Yeah. So those accounts were also very chilling.
In your family, have any accounts of the Civil War been handed down?
No. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It took myself and a first cousin, Gary Edwards, a lot of research even to find out what their names were. So it was because during the war, Marquis Colley disappeared for one reason or another. His son, John Lee Giles, no, I don't mean Marquis Colley, I mean Marquis Giles, my actual ancestor. And his son, John Lee Giles, and John Lee Giles' wife died within days of one another in the 1920s, leaving four children orphaned. And my grandfather at that time was very small. So, of course, he wouldn't remember any family story. So twice in two generations, we had orphaned or half-orphaned children.
Mm. Given your love of stories and folktales, I would imagine you come from a storytelling family.
Yes, very much so. And I have 25 first cousins on my dad's side. And the best of all of us at just simply oral storytelling is my cousin Bucky McNew. And he had a tavern in Poplar Bluff for a long time when he had Liar's Night on Thursday nights. And he would invariably win it and by applause, by the applause-o-meter. And he's absolutely wonderful at storytelling. And you can see him making instantaneous decisions as to whether this expression or that one is going to work or how to put an expression together. He talked about a man who was too big to be a human being and too small to be a Greyhound bus. That's the kind of thing he's very good at. So,
how old were you when you began to take note of that kind of detail?
My grandfather on my mother's side taught me so many songs, some of which I've never seen collected anywhere, but he learned them from his parents. And I remember how the song told a story, like The Fox and the Goose, for instance, would tell a story, and how Grandpa would put a story together in one way. And then I would notice that my great-uncle John would put a story together in another way, with another kind of emphasis. Like, Uncle John always emphasized exactly how long a thing was, how much it weighed. He was very much a person of weights and measurement, I suppose. Mm. And my grandfather loved anything that was romantic or a tearjerker.
Mm. And then when did you begin courting an audience? When did you want to sit down and tell others your stories or retell the stories you had learned?
Well, I was always sort of a shy child, and I much preferred writing things down than I did telling them exactly. But I put a little book together when I was 11 about horses, of course, about two girlfriends who had horses, and colored it and illustrated it and wrote it all out by hand and stapled it together and said, I've just written a book. And I got very excited and showed everyone, and everyone was very encouraging.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with this caller in Champaign County on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I have to open up my phone line, but I just I seem to remember that Ang Lee, the filmmaker from here, has a movie that dramatizes the Civil War in its chaotic form in Missouri, and I can't remember the title of it, and I wonder if you know about it, and it's something that I saw without knowing it was by Ang Lee at some relative's house, and it was quite evocative of the time, and I wish I could supply more information, but I can't sign on the net and look it up right at the moment, so I have to actually hang up and ask you if you know about it.
Yes. I think you're talking about Ride with the Devil, and that's about the Confederate guerrillas, or people who claimed to be on the Confederate side, in central Missouri. Those are Quantrill's guerrillas. That's what that story is about. Is that what you're referring to, is Ride with the Devil? Hello, I think he had to go off the air.
I think he had to go off
That's
the air
the movie
as well.
He's referring to. And it was much different up there than it was in the Ozarks.
Yeah. This matter of the guerrilla militias is quite interesting, too. And, it, you know, one wonders if they really had their particular, the cause that they were marching under, they really had that at heart, or if they had, you know.
Well, the Union Command early on sat down and made a very sensible decision about defining what a guerrilla was, instead of leaving it up to local commanders who would perhaps hang a guy because they knew him before the war and they'd never paid him for a horse or something. So, and it wasn't Halleck. I can't remember the general, but it's a long document, and I have it, a copy of it from the official records of the War of the Rebellion. And one important thing was you had to be in a chain of command. In other words, you had to have a superior officer from whom you took orders. You couldn't be bands of guys roaming around at will claiming to be fighting for the Confederate cause with no superior officer. So if a soldier being captured could supply evidence that he was part of a chain of command, this is my superior officer, he receives orders from this general, and then all the way to the top, generally they were not considered guerrillas. They could be perfectly well be out-of-control troops, though. In other words, Basil Lazier was a lieutenant colonel, and he was chided severely several times by his superior officers for his men going completely out of control. And although they were part of a chain of command, Union command, they were acting like guerrillas. So it was, there were rules, but it could get confusing.
Mm. I looked up, by the way, on the internet, Ang Lee and Ride with the Devil.
Yes.
And I have a review here by Roger Ebert, and he writes that the film is the first Civil War film he can recall that is not told with the benefit of hindsight. So it would be messy, wouldn't it? It's about characters who don't know the North will win and sometimes don't much seem to care.
Right, right.
It's said that all politics are local. This movie argues that some wars are local, too.
Yes.
And this is the film Ride with the Devil is based on the novel Woe to Live On by Daniel Woodrell. So there you go. What did we do before the internet? I don't know.
I don't know.
So are you at work on another novel, or what lies ahead for you now?
Well, dealing with the explosion of publicity for this book has been taking up quite a lot of my time. And it's been very enjoyable because I spent 7 years on my own researching it. Whenever I could put a few pennies together, I'd go up north or here or there to research and then write. So I'm kind of relaxing right now and dealing with the publicity part of it. But I'm also searching around a bit, looking into various other areas where I might find a tale waiting to be told. It's waiting for me.
Yeah. Well, you're there cleaning your stove.
Yes.
I hope that goes smoothly for you this
afternoon.
And then I hope you have a wonderful celebratory dinner this evening.
We will. Thank you, Celeste.
Thank you for talking with us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure. Paulette Giles has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Enemy Women. She's also the author of North Spirit, Travels Among the Cree and Ojibwe Nations, a book of poetry, Celestial Navigations, and a book of memoir, Cousins, Enemy Women. Her first novel is published by Morrow. And as we mentioned at the outset, it's just been optioned by 20th Century Fox.